A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making that pound in your pocket go a little bit further now. This is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, live into the studios. Editor Simon Lambert and journalist Lee Boyce are back with me for the weekly catch-up. We'll be talking about the stories that they've been investigating this week, including falling energy prices, QE, pensioner bonds, and how one London council's charging residents diesel tax on the very same cars that only a few years back it was actually encouraging them to buy. And staying with a motoring theme, do you remember this? How's Lada doing, by the way?
You basically pretty much can't buy a Lada nowadays. So I tell you what, though, they are now classic cars.
If
you
want Simon's a Lada, tried to buy one.
A Lada is a classic. If you can get your hands on a Lada and it's in good condition and you keep it, it will go up in value. You cannot say that about a brand new Ford Fiesta. That will lose money.
You could just buy a fridge and stick some wheels on it and put a Lada badge on it. That's basically what it is.
Ba-dum-bum. Ba-dum-bum. Indeed, those are the dulcet tones of Lee Boyce and Simon Lambert. Yes, whatever happened to Lada? Well, Lee's done a bit of digging around, got some good news. It's making something of a revival, the perennial butt of every car joke. Do you want to hear my favourite, lads? A man goes into a car accessory shop and says to the assistant, "Can I have a hubcap for my Lada?" The assistant thinks to himself for a moment and then replies, "OK, seems a fair swap."
Very good.
Very good, thank you, thank you. We're asking today, what blast from the past would you bring back? And what really, really should stay there? Annie, also, if you have any issues you'd like us or the This Is Money team to investigate, Annie will let you know how to get in contact. But Annie, what would you recommend?
Right.
Comes back?
I think what needs reviving from the dead is a series from the 90s that was on the BBC. It was set in the Costa del Sol. It was incredible. It was called El Dorado.
If only...
Oh, I absolutely loved
El Dorado. If only there was a video camera in here. Lee's face when you said that.
He shook his head.
Lee, you're not old enough to remember El Dorado.
I do remember El Dorado. Now, it would just be expats struggling to make a living.
Wouldn't it just? Yeah.
Exactly. It'd be completely different.
It wouldn't, actually. With the Euros, it would go that pound further. You can buy yourself some cheap property on the continent.
Is Benidorm not a reasonable replacement?
Is that
on? No, it's not. Not yeah, sure the characters were fantastic, and you had Marcus, the kind of slicked-haired businessman with his yacht. It was supposed to be EastEnders under the sun, but they axed it, and my friend was so horrified that she wrote to the BBC. So for me, I mean, the theme tune, everything, I absolutely adored El Dorado.
Sing the theme tune.
Da, 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 da. I can't, I'm getting emotional.
Oh,
I thought you were accidentally going to move into Howard's Way there.
Yeah, so that's what I would bring back. Other people have said, Donna said she used to have a Billy the Bass singing fish. It used to sing Take Me to the River. Hilarious, she says. And the best thing is that they are back. They're now available on Amazon.
Someone probably retired off the back of the Billy the Bass, didn't they?
Yeah.
They made a lot of money in a very short period of time and then moved off somewhere sunny.
Exactly. My other favourite one that's come in is Terry. Saying, bring back the crisps with a little salt sachet in them.
Yes!
Remember those?
Sorry, that was a little bit way excited then.
I think you can still get those. I'm fairly certain
really?
Those still exist.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
If it was any good, they're already back.
Yeah, true. Like Monster Munch, for example.
Yeah.
I've got some here. Just so anyway, we're still kind of looking for your ideas. So you can tweet us at Share Radio UK. Email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. Call us on 020-338-49849. You can also leave a message on our Facebook page.
Thank you very much, Annie. Before we move on, lads, what would you bring back on Retro Friday?
I'll tell you what I'd bring back. I would bring back Top of the Pops, but on a Thursday night, right? So Top of the Pops, when I was growing up, was awesome because basically it was the music from that week, pop music and stuff, and sometimes you'd actually get someone who was good on, so you'd be really excited.
Mm.
But the reason why Top of the Pops worked so well is because it used to be on, 7 o'clock on a Thursday night. And then they made the fatal decision to move it to a Friday, which was stupid because all of the people who'd be watching Top of the Pops, that sort of teenage audience or whatever, they'd be going out Friday night on a 7 o'clock.
Totally.
And that was when the viewing figures dropped and then they suddenly killed off Top of the Pops. And they went, oh, well, it's not relevant nowadays. And actually, it's just as relevant as it was. It was just some idiot decided to move it from a Thursday to a Friday. Bring it back Thursday night. I'd watch it and I bet loads of kids would too.
You've really thought about that, haven't you, Simon? Okay, there we
go. It's in my manifesto.
Start the campaign early.
Well, firstly, if you're going to save a retro 1990s soap, it's got to be Brookside. Eldorado. Ooh. Brookside was amazing.
Under the patio, Brookside.
Yeah, was it Trevor Jordash?
Keep it there.
But two things spring to mind. Toffos. Used to love a pack of Toffos. Do they still
exist? Still get those.
I've not seen them for a long
time. Yeah, they kind of come out at Christmas time.
Oh, I see. And Crystal Maze.
Yeah.
How amazing would the Crystal Maze be now?
Such a good shout.
But I've heard you can actually go there for like a stag do. It still exists. It was really expensive for Channel 4 to construct. So.
Who knew? It's another report, ideally.
Well, it could well be.
I reckon we should get like a blow heater or something in here. Stick in some gold and silver money.
That would be amazing.
We could
that
have
would
our
be
own share
a childhood
radio.
Come true. A childhood dream come
brilliant.
True.
Brilliant.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Not sure how I will segue from that into our next story, so I won't bother and just say before we turn our attentions across the waters to QE and the ECB, we're going to go a little bit closer to home and Npower's confirmed they're the latest energy supplier to announce that prices are coming down. The firm's standard gas tariff is being cut by an average of 5.1% from the 16th of February. It follows Scottish Power, British Gas and E.ON, who've already announced reductions following falling wholesale prices. British Gas cut its standard gas tariff by 5% earlier this week. Scottish Power by 4.8%. E.ON 3.5% last week. So let's start with you then, Simon. Will EDF and Scottish firm SSE, the last of the big six, follow suit, do you think?
I think they probably will. I mean, it would be a turn up for the books if they decided to put their prices up, wouldn't it? I think this is the time of year when we're normally getting very upset with the energy firms raising prices again. And this year, obviously, they're cutting them. The reason for that is basically falling energy costs. We've seen the oil price slump and we've also seen wholesale energy costs come down. But the question that's being asked now is whether they should be cutting these costs by even further for the consumer. The difficulty is that the power companies will argue, well, actually, those wholesale costs only make up a certain chunk of your energy bills. And there's lots of other stuff involved in sort of the cost of delivery, green taxes and all those other things that go into it. But I think we're probably going to see across-the-board cuts this year, which is good news for people.
How much is the election going to play into this? Because I don't know what's going to happen after the election.
Well, there's a huge amount of political pressure on the big six to bring down their prices because I think last year's rises were the straw that broke the camel's back and they got a lot of grief from the consumer, from MPs. The industry, you know, argued that it had no choice but to put up prices. But what you had coming against them there, which is something that's made a real difference, is all the small energy players saying, well, we're not putting our prices up by that much and we don't recognise this scenario that you're describing. And if, as a small company, we can compete better on price, why aren't you competing better on price? And don't underestimate the pressure that those small companies like the OVO Energies put on the big six, to be perfectly honest.
Lee, your thoughts on this?
One thing that really sticks out in my mind about this is the fact that some of the energy providers aren't making these cuts until the end of February. Which, you know, it's still cold at that time of year, but the main heating usage, you know, will be now. You know, it's cold. It's one of the coldest mornings I can remember in a long time. You know, this is when people are using their heating. It's no good if these cuts are going to come in at the end of next month. Why not right now? You know, one of them has, and E.ON, straight away, cuts have been made. But what's the delay? Why are they taking their time to do it?
Well, that's a question. What is the delay? Why are they taking their time to do it, Simon?
Because they're sneaky. Lee's right, that's happening. It is sneaky. And if we look back, going back each year when those prices were going up, you would have found that the prices were rising pretty much immediately. There's a very strong argument that they should be coming down now. There's a very strong argument that they should have come down already. I think that the thing to take away from this for people is that even though prices are falling, and you might see that your provider has actually cut what you're going to pay, be it now or be it in a couple of months' time, it is still worth considering switching your energy bills. If you've never done it, most people could save a couple of £100 a year, £200-300. Even if you have done it, you could probably save £100 or so. I actually switched at the sort of end of last year. I did a you can do a comparison on This Is Money. It's powered by Energy Helpline. And I did it, and it came up. I was with Npower. It came up that I could move to OVO. I could take their green energy package, so I'm supporting, you know, renewable electricity, and I was saving £150. To me, that sounds like a big winner. So it was bye-bye Npower and hello OVO.
It's also worth pointing out, though, that not everyone's going to get these reductions. It's only certain tariffs anyway.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that's why you should be sitting down and thinking about switching. And it's actually a really, really simple and easy process. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/fuelbills, you will find an explanation and a little calculator. You put your postcode in, you do the comparison, and it pretty much does all the work for you. You might have to take a meter reading. That's not the hardest thing to do in the world. Says the man who hasn't taken his meter reading yet.
I was going to say, it couldn't be simpler, could it? Hey, Simon. Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money and journalist Lee Voice with us.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now let's turn our attention to money printing press. Ramp them up, well, sort of, I suppose, as the European Central Bank announces it's pumping at least 1.1 trillion euros into the ailing eurozone economy. ECB President Mario Draghi says they'll buy bonds worth 60 billion euros per month until the end of September 2016 and possibly beyond in what's known as quantitative easing, or QE for those in the know and don't want to say quantitative easing. So how does QE work? Apparently it's like financial magic. We'll have a listen to this.
Jargon Busters, leading you through the financial labyrinth.
Have you ever seen a magician seemingly create something out of thin air? Wow, you're amazed, but you know somewhere in the back of your mind it was there to begin with, and it's just a trick. But did you know that real wizardry exists? Quantitative easing is a type of financial magic. When the government wants to stimulate the economy, they need to lower the interest rates and increase their money supply. One way of doing this is to buy back bonds from investors with money they have newly created. They can print new money, or they can just magic it out of thin air through quantitative easing, otherwise known as QE. QE enables the government or Bank of England to create money digitally by just adding it to an account electronically. They use this newly created cash to buy back bonds and distribute it to banks. Ta-da! It's like magic. You're obviously thinking, you can't just add some zeros to an account and make money, can you? Yes, actually you can. Well, the government can anyway. It's the financial equivalent of flying a helicopter over London, throwing out loads of £5 notes and hoping people spend it in a way that will help the economy. By late 2014, the Bank of England had spent £375 billion on its quantitative easing asset purchase to keep the economy afloat after the financial crisis of 2007. Now that is a magic trick worth knowing.
Before we do start talking about QE or queasy, Morning Money's Mark Johnson calls it. Simon, what was your suggestion just there? You rather like those little jargon busters that we play out here on Share Radio. There's lots of them. That was one about quantitative easing. Does sound a little bit like perhaps a call waiting, maybe, if you're phoning up a Chinese restaurant or something, didn't you suggest that?
Well, I think the government should bring in these little explanations instead of hold music when you're trying to call them up. So, say, for example, you were waiting to call the tax man. Instead of having to listen to sort of some endless hold music or whatever the tax man gives you, they could give you an explanation of why you should put more money in your pension.
Or the pensioner bonds helpline. We'll be talking about pensioner bonds a bit later on. But, yeah, not a bad suggestion, I think, there. So that, bringing back Top of the Pops, your manifesto's coming together nicely.
It is, yes. And I will tell you a little bit more about it later when we talk about Islington Council's diesel tax.
Yeah, excellent. I look forward to that. So, Simon, give us some context to this then, this QE. What's led to a situation where over a trillion euros is needed to sort out the EU economy?
Well, the EU, the eurozone, there's been this discussion of whether it would do QE for quite a long time. The US did it a long time ago and has actually now stopped its third round of QE. The Bank of England did it immediately after the financial crisis. We've stopped as well. The eurozone's been very late to the party with this. And they've only just announced that they're going to do it. Now, one of the reasons behind that is because it's a currency union. There's 19 member nations, and so you've got to get everybody to agree. And there was one rather large and important member who has been very, very anti-QE there, which is the Germans. They are concerned that it leads to basically letting off the troubled economies, letting them off the hook, basically, that they won't make the economic reforms that they need to because they'll just rely on this cheap money. They're also concerned about inflation, that ultimately this will prove to be you know, deliver very high inflation. And in Germany, there is obviously a very big concern about hyperinflation if you look way back into history about that. But we've hit crunch time now. The Eurozone is in deflation. So its inflation figure was minus 0.2% in December. It's got stagnant growth. The economies, the peripheral economies, are really struggling. Even the German economy has slowed down. The French economy is struggling. Italy, don't underestimate, you know, the importance of Italy, which is a very big economy in the Eurozone. That's got real problems. And also Greece has got a snap election where potentially a left-wing party, Syriza, I think is how you pronounce it, looks like they could get elected. And the concern is that they might take Greece out of its bailout conditions, essentially leading to Greece defaulting on its debt. And then this crunch question of, does Greece then get kicked out of the Eurozone? So everything's been building up to this. Yesterday, Mario Draghi stood up and announced that they're going to print 60 billion euros a month. The plan is until September 2016, but he left it hanging a bit, and it could be open-ended until they can push inflation back towards their 2% target. Is it going to work? Who knows?
We shall see, indeed. Well, it's hoped it'll make borrowing cheaper so people spend more, of course, boosting the economy in the process. Germans not the only ones who are concerned about it. Chancellor George Osborne, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, also had his reservations.
I don't think central bank action alone can rescue the Eurozone economy. It can help, but it needs to be accompanied by a serious programme of economic reform, public finances that are in good order, clear economic leadership.
I mean, that's the issue, though, isn't it, Simon? Money creation alone is not going to be enough to fix the Eurozone.
The Eurozone, in my personal opinion, has a fundamental problem, which is that what it has done is it has taken disparate economies that move at very different speeds and have very different characters, and it's pushed them all together. There was a lot of bending the rules in order for everybody to get into the Euro, and we had that period, you know, 2000 to 2007, when money was good, living was easy, and people were spending money that they didn't have. Greece racked up huge debts, for example, but someone was selling the Greeks all of that stuff. And I do remember an anecdotal thing that said that apparently Athens was the Porsche Cayenne capital of Europe. There were more Porsche Cayennes bought in Athens than anywhere else. And the Germans were making those Porsches and selling them to the Greeks, and their economy was doing very well off the back of it. Now, you've then got this situation where you've got austerity being imposed to try and make these economic reforms. But austerity, by its very nature, making people cut back on spending, especially if you've got countries with large state spending, is going to be deflationary. Because unless you can devalue your currency, which if you're within the currency union, you cannot do because you share a currency with everybody else, then the only way to become more competitive is to bring down the cost of wages and to bring down the cost of goods. And that in itself is deflationary. So I think it's actually a natural product of austerity. And if you go back in history, you can look at, say, for example, the Italian economy. The Italian economy has these wonderful bursts of productivity and does really well. And then it gets into trouble. And what always used to happen was they would basically, the lira would devalue, Italy would become more competitive because its exports were now cheaper for people to buy. It would take some pain, then it would pick back up, and it was back on its way again. And Italy has not had that option since it took the euro, and Italy has done really badly since the euro came in. And if it wasn't for the euro, then ultimately it probably would have devalued about 5 years ago and would be back on its way up by now.
The former US Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who's a professor of economics at Harvard University, so should know a thing or two, said the risk of doing too little far exceeds the risks of doing too much. Deflation and secular stagnation are the macroeconomic threats of our time.
This is basically pretty much the thinking that influences most central bank action around the world at the moment. There's very much a consensus on this. I think the German Bundesbank has been pushing against that consensus. But basically, it is this idea of, well, you got to do something. So, and the risk of doing too little is much greater than the risk of doing too much. So you've had this wall of money thrown at problems through, you know, QE in the US, in the UK, in Japan, doing an astonishing amount of this, and now the Eurozone. What I think is interesting about it is that it's very difficult to tell whether it actually works, but the general economic theory is that what it does is it staves off worse problems so that it probably doesn't hurt. So would we have done worse without it? Most people think we probably would have done.
We've said, I mean, it's not worked so much in Japan, for example. In America, it seemed to work, but it's a very different environment with which you're bringing QE in those different places. America brought it after the crash. The Fed, as did we. Very different environments.
It is. And the one thing that we probably can say about QE is it lifts asset prices. So what it does is this money. So the central bank basically creates some money. And then it injects that into the financial system by buying second-hand government bonds. They buy those off investors. Investors then have all of this money and they need to do something with it. Where are they going to put it? They're going to put it somewhere where they can get a better return. So some of it finds its way into the stock market. Some of it finds its way into bonds. Some of it has found its way into sort of hard assets. One of the things driving London property prices over the past 5 years has been all this money washing around the globe and rich people looking for somewhere to put it. The short-term effect of those asset prices rising is that it improves confidence. And, you know, economies are like markets. They're all about sentiment. You need to get that confidence to pick up. And I think an analogy that you could draw is that QE is basically like you've got an engine that's faulty and it's like spraying vast quantities of oil onto that engine. It's not going to fix the engine, but it buys you time to get somewhere and to try and get that engine fixed. And I think that that is probably the theory behind QE, to be honest.
Let's focus a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, before we move on to pension bonds. What it mean for us here in the UK? We've been hearing a lot of newspapers this morning talking about cheaper holidays, rising pension funds, property bargains on the continent. Also, we've got to bear in mind that the Eurozone is the UK's biggest trading partner. So if it recovers, good for exporters, of course, but won't it move us slightly closer to deflation by lowering perhaps the sterling price of goods and services made in the Eurozone here in Britain?
Well, I mean, from most people's point of view, if you look at it from the point of the man in the street's pocket or woman in the street's pocket in Britain, you look at the pound rising against the euro and you go, well, that's a great thing. You know, I'm going to get more for my money when I go on holiday. Things are going to get slightly cheaper if we're importing them into the country. But actually, behind this, you've got to remember that the Bank of England and the government don't want the pound to rise too much against the euro, because what we want to be doing is exporting stuff to the eurozone. We want the prices of our goods to be good value in the eurozone. And if the pound starts rising too much against the euro, then that's not going to happen. So a strong pound is actually not so great for the UK economy. What this ultimately means is that basically interest rates are not going anywhere in this country for some time. We had the minutes of the last Bank of England MPC meeting this week. We've had two people on the MPC voting for a rise in interest rates. They changed their mind now in December and they've said that they're concerned about deflation. And now it was a unanimous vote to keep interest rates on hold. The money markets are suggesting that rates might not even rise this year. I'm not sure whether that's a given. That kind of thing moves around quite a lot.
Yeah.
But certainly the Bank of England will be looking at Eurozone QE and saying, well, that's going to depress the euro. And so we need to keep interest rates low, because if we raise interest rates while they're on the floor in the Eurozone and they're printing money, you're going to see the pound rise against the euro. And they don't really want that.
I should also say, welcome back, Simon, from your holiday in Europe, in Austria it was. You went at the wrong time.
No. I tell you what. So markets, basically, the way markets work is they anticipate things. There's this phrase about how it's better to travel than to arrive, and that once something actually happens, it's done. And so by the time I went last weekend, the pound was already at €1.30. You know, go back not so long ago, and that would have been 1.20. Go back not so many years and that was nearly 1-1.
Yeah, exactly. And I can also be a little bit smug as well, because I don't know if you were listening last week, Rachel Rickard-Strauss here and Ed, we were talking about buying tickets, the extortionate prices of tickets that was on your website, and how I had to fork out 4 James Taylor tickets. Yes, in Dusseldorf, I managed to get those tickets. €214. But I've worked out that with the loss of 6% value over the last year in the euro to the pound, I saved myself a tenner.
Wow, they're an investment.
Exactly. Well, I wouldn't go that far. But tenner. I mind you, my maths is so bad, it's probably not even remotely close to that. But it sounds about right. So coming up, we'll be talking about pension bonds.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. This is time of the week where we speak to This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online, and welcome editor Simon Lambert and journalist Lee Boyce into the studios. Let's turn our attention to pensioner bonds, and I know this is a story for you, Lee. Now, when they went on sale, the hope was that these high-interest government-backed bonds were an easy and simple way for over 65s to make a little bit of money. However, National Savings and Investment apparently now face something of a clean-up operation after savers attempting to take out bonds reported money missing from their accounts and multiple debits for the same application. And of course, it comes after the NS&I website crashed, of course, and phone lines jammed as people rushed out to grab these bonds before they sold out. Lee, can you just give us a little bit more background to this story?
I kind of did. You know, I was gutted last Friday when I wasn't here. You know, I've been talking about pensioner bonds for
months.
It
was your moment of glory.
It was my moment of glory.
Where
and
were
it
you?
Was taken away from me. It was stripped away. So pensioner bonds, just to recap, are available to the over 65s. They offer 2.8% over 1 year and 4% over 3 years. Now, we knew there was going to be strong demand for these products because they beat anything else that's out in the savings market at the moment. Some million people pre-registered their interest. I mean, that's a fair whack of people that were interested in taking this out. Now, this week, as you say, there was a lot of website hoo-ha on Thursday and Friday, people swamping the website, and it, kind of understandable, but at the same time, they should have known that there was going to be a huge demand. Now, what's happened this week is that lots of readers have been in touch with me to say they've had duplicate payments come out of their account. So, for instance,
tell us about Pam, because this is an extraordinary story.
So she just wanted to open one bond for £10,000, which is a maximum allowed into one of these bonds. And she was told it hadn't gone through. It was two payments she tried. She tried it once. It was declined. So she got through to the webpage, said the payment hadn't gone through. So she tried again, got the same message, decided just to leave it at that. When she finally managed to get in touch with a bank, there was £20,000 pending to leave her bank account. So the payments had actually happened, but they've been sort of in a black hole. NS&I can't tell her if it's been opened, no reference number.
In your article, it says the NS&I told her it was very worried as it didn't know why the second payment had been taken and couldn't find any record of the money. Another department is now investigating the missing money. That's not what you want to be told by someone, that they are very worried.
It really isn't. And she's not the only one that's been in touch with similar problems. So I don't know how big this problem is, because NS&I won't tell me how many duplicate payments have been made. I don't know if it can really be able to do that anyway. And how many refunds are sort of pending to come back. But some people in customer services have been saying that it could take 21 days for a refund, which is a long time to be waiting for tens of thousands of pounds. Now, NS&I have told me that that is not true, and payments should be happening fairly, you know, refunds should be happening fairly shortly. But there's lots of people out there that don't know if they've opened a bond, they don't know what's happening. And it's very difficult still to get hold of NS&I.
Well, you don't know if you're going to get the bond, and then you don't know if you're going to get the money back. And by the time, if you get the money back, you may be too late.
Well, this is it. So I crunched some figures earlier in the week.
Now, are they as good as my £10 euro?
I think they're on par.
They're probably better. I'd hope they're better.
Well, I hope they're better, yes.
Well, I checked his, so okay. So they might be better.
On Thursday and Friday, interestingly, Chancellor George Osborne came out, said more than £1 billion had been poured into these accounts on Thursday and Friday. He's very happy at the fact, you know, it's been very successful, he says. Mm. But interestingly, he said that they'll be on sale for months. I crunched the figures. If they sold at the same pace as those first 2 days, they'd be sold out by the end of the month. There's only £10 billion that can go into these accounts.
Bearing in mind the first 2 days when there was phone line problems and website crash.
Exactly, and that doesn't also count postal applications, which, of course, is going to be pretty popular with the over 65s. So I asked yesterday afternoon for an update. You would have thought they can give me an update of how much has been poured into these accounts, but they refused to give me an update. So they can give an update after less than 48 hours, but they can't give me an update after a week.
I imagine you'll keep trying, Lee.
Indeed.
What should people do then if they are confused? Also, you'd want to know about it, so how can they contact you as well?
You can email me at lee.boyce@thisismoney.co.uk, which lots of people already have. So I've been forwarded them emails onto NS&I's press office as a sort of solution, because people are just struggling to get through on the phone lines. Now, they have 300 staff in their call centre. They've taken on an extra 100 over last weekend. Just to keep trying, that's all you can do. it's really difficult because some people are going to get, have chosen to have their application detail sent them through the post, which they wouldn't have received yet, some through email. And it's just a big mix up for some people. I mean, I think you just got to keep plugging away or get in touch with me and see if I can help you out.
Absolutely. As Ed said last week, every big government thing seems to be accompanied by a big crash, doesn't it?
Well, let's not forget, this has been the most popular financial product for a long, long time. So it was kind of inevitable, but there must have been ways to prevent it. They must have done some predictions as to how many people were going to try and...
Doesn't inspire confidence. This was almost entirely predictable. As Lee said, if 1 million people pre-registered their interest, and also 1 million people, those 1 million people could take out 2 bonds, so they could do £20,000 each. Mm-hmm. If they only took out £10,000 each, that 1 million people, that would be your £10 billion done. So, you know, it's pretty obvious that there's going to be a huge amount of demand, and I think it's a bit shoddy, to be perfectly honest.
Editor Simon Lambert and journalist Lee Boyce add shoddy pensioner bonds to Simon's manifesto.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Also, to add to that, a bitter blow for diesel car owners in Islington. That's because the local council have slapped a tax on diesel cars. It wouldn't be surprising, apart from the fact that this was the same council that was actively encouraging local people to buy diesel back in 2007. Now, we should start off by saying you've got a bit of confession here, Simon, because, well, you are a local resident.
I am a local resident. I have a vested interest here. I live in Islington and I do have a diesel car. However, my objection to this does not just stand on the fact that I don't want to pay them an extra £96 a year. My objection to this is that, firstly, it's slightly spurious. What the council has done is basically it's turned round and it's said, we have decided that diesel cars are bad for people, that they pollute more. They may have lower CO2 emissions, but they emit dangerous particles, and that's bad for people's health. And we want people to change their behaviour. We want them to get different cars. So we're bringing in a £96 a year diesel surcharge, they've called it.
When are they bringing it in?
From April. But from let's April. Be honest, it's a diesel tax. And it's a blanket £96 a year. If you own a diesel car, you have to pay for your parking permit, which could be already costing you £90 a year, could be costing you more. I think ours costs us £130. And then you have to pay an extra £96 a year on top of it. Now, firstly, I don't think it's necessarily up to councils to be making these decisions. I think councils should probably focus on making sure that the local area runs properly. And if the government wants to bring something in road tax, that it thinks that diesel people should be moved away from diesel cars, maybe it should do that. But a residence parking scheme is theoretically there to benefit residents and to make sure that they can park their own car outside their house. I don't think it should be charging people over £200 a year. I don't think it should be used to try and change behaviour. But secondly, it has actually already been being used to try and change behaviour because in 2007, they brought in parking permits graded on CO2 emissions, which encouraged people to buy cars that had lower CO2 emissions. And that's been the situation for the past 8 years. And that has actively encouraged people to go out and buy diesel cars, efficient diesel cars that have lower CO2 emissions. And what they've done is suddenly staged a U-turn and told them that actually, no, we've decided these are bad for you now, and we're going to charge you £96. Understandably, people aren't happy about this.
To I'm encourage not, people, though, yeah. to go out and buy greener cars, yeah, but not everyone but, can afford to do
well,
that.
Well, this is the thing, because, and I should point out that this is not a political issue, but this is a Labour-run council, OK? And this is a deeply regressive tax, because if the idea behind this, which is what has been used to justify it, is that they want to move people towards buying a different kind of car, the people who are most likely to be able to get a different kind of car are wealthy people. The people who are least likely to be able to get a different kind of car are people on lower incomes. And so they basically, not only is a £96 a year tax going to take proportionally more of their income, so it's regressive, they're also less likely to be able to change their behaviour. And this is not nudge theory, this is bludgeon theory, to be perfectly honest. And it's also a little bit convenient that it comes in just at the time when the council are facing more cuts. To be honest, I think it's absolutely disgraceful.
But some people might say, like you said, councils are facing a big squeeze on their finances and cuts. And actually, should we not penalise those people that are driving and polluting?
Maybe, but I would say two things to that. Firstly, they're not allowed to use this money for anything other than streets and traffic. It has to be ring-fenced. Now, there is a little bit of sneakiness here because, basically, they make a tidy profit on parking in Islington. In fact, the most recent figures for its surplus, which is the 2012-2013 year, was £6.7 million. Now, they've also given some details about how they spend that. And if you look down the categories, they spent £250,000 on road safety, £725,000 on transport planning, £2.7 million on highway improvements. Now, I think that's the bit where they fix the roads and the pavements. And then traffic and engineering improvements, £2.96 million on that. So that's the largest amount. And looking at the other categories, I think that actually that one might just be general meddling, bringing in some more speed bumps, closing off a couple of roads here and there. They proudly decided to become London's first 20-mile-an-hour borough. But in order to make this sort of self-aggrandising boast, they've introduced 20-mile-an-hour speed limits on the main roads that they control, which is fine in rush hour, but actually it's ridiculously slow on empty roads at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I just think that, to be perfectly honest, the council should really stick to its knitting, and if it can't fix the roads and the pavements properly, then it shouldn't be wandering around trying to tell people what they should be doing. And I also think that this actually does undermine the council's argument, which it does have an argument. There is a crisis in council tax funding at the moment. Most people don't realise that the vast majority of council tax they pay doesn't go to their council, goes to the government, who then redistributes it. Councils have very little power to raise money locally, and they have actually seen huge cuts to their budgets, and they're struggling to deliver the essentials. Yet their ability to put forward that argument and win people over to say, actually, we need to take some more money off you to do the essential stuff, is fatally undermined by bringing in things like a £96 a year diesel tax. People hate that, and I don't understand why they keep doing it.
And breathe. Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money. We'll take a brief pause while Simon gets his breath back and gets to a more perhaps neutral colour. You've gone a bit pink there, Simon.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
If you are affected by any of the stories that we're talking about today, or you've got an opinion on them, do get in contact with us. Annie, how can people get in contact?
So you can tweet us at Share Radio UK, email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. You can call us on 020-338-49849, and you can also leave a message on our Facebook page.
Simon, how can people get in contact with you guys?
They can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, and they can tweet us at thisismoney. And if they just come to thisismoney.co.uk, they'll find all numbers of ways to get in touch with us. So, and they can leave a comment on our story. And I should say that, in my defence, most of the comments on the article I wrote about the diesel tax thing this week were broadly supportive of me and said that they thought that this was outrageous, which is rare because readers normally just like to lambast us.
Sadly, I don't have those comments there, so I'll just have to take your word for it, Simon. We've discussed pension bonds, now let's turn our attention to premium bonds. Were you one of the lucky winners in the first premium bonds draw of 2015? It's a very happy start to the year for two players who won £1 million each this month. One of the lucky winners is a lady from Leeds who holds only £400 in premium bonds. The second is a lady living in Bristol. She had a total holding of £30,000. Well, every month This Is Money publishes details of premium bonds prize winner jackpots. This week you guys put up a table ordered by location to show how well your neighbours did in the monthly draw of January. Starting though, I don't know about neighbours, starts in Australia and then moves down to Barnet and that sort of thing. Where did you find this from, this table?
We get the information from NS&I each month, and we publish premium bond winners tables each month, and they're hugely popular, which is surprising in a way when you consider that if you do win the premium bonds people will actually notify you themselves. And I don't know how many people actually have their individual bond numbers to go check on the internet, for example. But I think what it shows is just that quite how captivated the nation is by premium bonds.
Explain to us, if someone could, what is a premium bond?
Well, Lee is the man here, because Lee is our savings correspondent and he is our premium bonds
Lee,
expert.
What is a premium bond?
Premium bonds, I think the best way to really think about it is almost like playing the lottery, but without losing your return. So £1 buys you one bond, and you're entered into the earning machine. So it has a draw every month. You have to have a minimum of £100 of bonds. And you just put in, it's almost like a big raffle throughout the whole country. It's been going for, you know, decades now. People see it as a safe investment. I mean, it has an average return of 1.35%, which isn't high, but if you look at some of the easy access savings accounts out there, you know, they are rock bottom. And people just like that element of being in that draw, I think, and knowing that they could win £1 million, but
without the risk.
Exactly, you're not having to lose £2 every week, you know, to take that risk. You know, it's just there. And I think, yeah, I think it's just one of those products that people just really like to hold. I think if you look at the list that we published, I mean, a lot of the winners hold maximum holdings. So the maximum holding was £30,000. Mm. It's recently gone up to £40,000. It's going to go up to £50,000 this year. And you look at that list, and a lot of the big winners do have big amounts, and it shows you how popular they are. So people that are obviously cash rich are still putting it into this relatively safe product.
And it's just a luck of the draw.
It's luck of the draw, yeah. The odds, I think, are 26,000 to 1 for each bond to win one prize, and bearing in mind some of the prizes are £25, etc. So the odds of winning the jackpot are very, very, very long. I have worked out the odds before. I haven't got them in front of me, but they are long.
Did Simon check those figures, though, is the question?
I think NS&I checked the figures.
Okay, are they not a little bit busy at the moment, NS&I? Honestly, guys.
Just checking his figures. I think one of the other important points to make about premium bonds is that those prizes are tax-free as well. So, you know, they're more comparable to a cash ISA than they are to a standard savings account. And I think for a lot of people, they're just a kind of, they're the default investment. They feel, oh, I've put too much money into a savings account, I'll put it into the premium bonds because it's safe. Probably a lot of those people, actually, if they've got a reasonable amount of cash savings, should, if you were going to be doing some financial planning, be investing the money instead to get a higher return. But they don't want to take that risk. And I mean, I've got a couple of comments here. So a chap called PV from London says, I make more with premium bond winners than I get in monthly interest from any of my savings accounts or ISAs these days, usually about £50 a month. I get more excitement waiting for the draw results from Ernie than the disappointment when I see my interest reduced again and again, month on month, despite saving more and more. And another chap called Spudhead from Belfast says, I don't know why people are complaining. My wife and I win on a regular monthly basis, usually £50 to £100. Not much, but on an annual basis it all adds up, and much better than cash ISA returns. There is an interesting point to make here. Me and Lee were talking about this on the way over here, which is if you do find that you have a year where you win lots on the premium bonds, that's actually the time when you should sell them, because statistically you're only likely to get the average return. So if you do better than the average return, the theory of mean reversion says that in forthcoming years you will do worse in order to get back to that average, so you should sell them at that point. But that's not how people work, and that's not how people think.
No, indeed. Did you do maths at university or something, Simon?
I just read stuff.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. That's straight over my head then. So you've looked into where in the UK indeed people are winning these. Is there a particular place we should go where we're more lucky?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a broad stroke of areas. You know, you look at that list, it's a good list. But once I did a top five premium bond myths, and people wrote in with what they think, you know, premium bonds and what the problems are with it. And one of the myths was that only bonds from the southeast win. So I put all these questions to NS&I. It says, if it seems that more prizes are won by holders in the southeast, that's because there were more bonds held there compared with the rest of the UK. So that list, it's very difficult to say, you know, here, there or the other, because people in the southeast might hold 70% of bonds. You just don't know how the makeup is. But no, you know, it's pure chance.
People love a conspiracy bonds theory,
especially when it involves the North-South divide.
They love them. You've got some other ones there, haven't you, Lee?
Got some great ones. So these were ones that readers sort of come into us. So one of them was, you have to have the maximum invested to win the jackpot. So only those that have massive holdings. And NS&I said that one draw, someone had just £17 in premium bonds and won the £1 million jackpot. So that would have been someone from a long time ago when before the holding was up to £100. Only new bonds win prizes. Apparently that's not true. In a recent draw, £1,000 was won with a bond bought in 1970. So it's things that people say, oh, this is premium bonds, this and the other. But it's just down to chance. It's down to luck.
It was said, though, that in 2014, over £41 million of these premium bonds prizes went unclaimed. Why is that?
People tend to hold a lot of bonds, and they might not be registered with NS&I online. I think they've started this new drive to get people to register online so they can be notified via email. But if it's smaller prizes, I don't think NS&I are going to be, you know, breaking their back to contact
you. They send you a letter, but people move, don't they? And they don't update their address and things like that. In fact, actually, the other interesting thing about premium bonds is if you win a million, there's a person who works for them called Agent Million who comes around and tells you personally. You don't wait for a letter. You don't check it online. You don't even read it on This Is Money. They come around and tell you. And Lee has spoken to Agent Million.
You've spoken to Agent Million.
I was in awe. It was like speaking to the biggest personal finance celebrity you could ever imagine.
Oh, wow.
We had an exclusive interview with her a couple of years ago. Yeah, you should go check it out. It's great. It's a great read, if I do say so myself.
We'll pull it up and we'll stick it at the top of the website today. But there was a great anecdote she told you, which was where basically she can only tell the winner. And so she goes around to people's houses, and she's had to ring on the doorbell in the daytime and ask to speak to Mr. So-and-so. And the wife opens the door and she says, can I speak to Mr. So-and-so? And the wife says, well, he's not in. He's at work. Why do you want to speak to him? And she says, well, I can't tell you. Yeah. And she says, well, can I say who it is? And she says, well, I can't tell you that. So the wife's immediately think, oh, yeah, what's my husband up to?
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. And then, lo and behold,
he's a millionaire.
A millionaire. And all is forgiven and forgotten.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now, we have been speaking all about pension bonds, premium bonds, euro slumps, quantitative easing, and also cars. Let's talk about cars. We've spoken about diesel tax. A number of cars, firstly, built in the UK, has reached a seven-year high. More than 1.5 million were made in 2014, with a new car rolling off production every 20 seconds. The Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders says its figures show that more than £7 billion of investment over the past 2 years is starting to have an effect on the industry. So, Lee, you're the car man. We'll be talking about Lada in a sec. But first of all, every 20 seconds, a new car rolls off the production line here.
Well, people are more interested in buying new cars now than the slump, you know, 2009, 2010. It's slowly building up, people buying cars. A lot of it is built on finance. There's a lot of good finance deals out there at the moment. People are feeling a little bit more safer in their jobs and the economy's improving slightly. And people are just more inclined to, you know, get a new car. A lot of them offer better economy and technology is improving.
The other thing that's been said to be boosting it is obviously the cheap finances, Lisa, yeah, but also PPI payments. People getting a couple of grand in PPI reclaim and then putting that down as the deposit on a new car.
So all of this is good for us with the new cars. Also great for the UK with all this car production.
Our car industry is doing really well at the moment. We will get comments on stories saying, ah, but who owns it? It's not UK owned. But that doesn't matter. These are UK companies making UK products. And
employing
companies
UK staff.
Like, yeah, Jaguar Land Rover doing phenomenally well at the moment. Really, really good. Rolls-Royce is doing well. Bentley's doing well. Nissan does really well
Cash
up in the northeast.
Sunderland, I know we mentioned
they make,
before, yeah, you know.
They make more cars up there in the northeast than Italy produces from the whole country.
I like a good stat. Is that it for our second-hand car industry then?
No,
what's
people still love
there?
Secondhand cars.
They do love. We love a retro car. Do you remember this? How's Lada doing, by the way?
You basically pretty much can't buy a Lada nowadays. So I tell you what, though, they are now classic cars. If you can get your hands on a Lada and it's in good condition and you keep it, it will go up in value.
You could just buy a fridge and stick some wheels on it and put a Lada badge on it. That's basically what it is.
Ba-dum-bum. Lee, being the consummate professional investigative journalist that you are, took that to heart. Did a bit of investigative journalism.
What
did you find?
Lada, you can buy a brand new one in Northamptonshire.
Oh, wow.
It's absolutely, it's life-changing.
I need a cheery
well, this
sound
is, this
effect.
This is it. So you put me to task, George. You know, we talk about Ladas. Can you buy a brand new Lada? Straight back in the office. And I was thinking about it all day and I had to scratch that itch and find out. So I got onto this guy. He sells Lada 4x4s, the Lada Niva, which is a rather lovely-looking car, which you can go and have a look at on our website.
You sent a photo of it with a picture of me doctored next to it, which I put on Twitter, so do go to the Share Radio Twitter.
Glad you enjoyed it, because
yeah, it
you are over Vladimir Putin, and I hope he doesn't see that, because, you know, that might be...
Anyway,
right. he's selling these cars. They're just under £13,000, and he told me that... sounds are not massive. You know, we're not talking thousands of cars, but they're quite handy for people who go through rugged terrain, such as farmers. And they would usually go for a Land Rover Defender. Now, they're going to cease production at the end of the year. And he's saying, he's billing this as a bit of a replacement for them because they are built like tanks and they will withstand a lot of stuff. Now, my favourite quote about this was from James May from Top Gear. And he said that it was like a Randy Goat, which I think is just pretty much the best description of a car. They should just maybe do an advert and just
a
say...
A Randy Goat? Yeah. What do you think he meant by that?
I think he's saying it skips around sort of tough farm terrain like a Randy Goat. So it's nimble. It doesn't look nimble, but it is nimble. And I think some people might start buying these cars.
Do you reckon?
I really do, yeah.
Simon?
So, I mean, what I said was, I said it's very hard to buy a Lada nowadays. And actually, I'm wrong, because actually you can still buy them brand new. So if you buy an old Lada and hold on to it, it will actually, you know, they are actually considered a minor classic. And you hold on to them in a minor classic. But if you buy one of these brand new ones, it will probably go down in value. I should say that. But I think they're great cars. They're cool. I remember, actually, when I was at school, and I was about the third year, someone in the sixth form had one of these, and that was prime Lada joke time, that was. If you had owned a Lada back then, you would have been mocked. Yet the Lada 4x4 was different. It looked cool. And I think that basically, if you're the kind of person who thinks that the first thing you might do with your new car is reverse it into a gatepost, this is the ideal car for you. If you're a farmer or someone who's, you know, likes the rugged terrain, and you're probably the first thing you do with your new car is dent the panels in a couple of weeks, then...
Sign me up. what do you call a convertible Lada?
Skip.
Yeah, what do you call a convertible Lada with twin exhausts?
Wheelbarrow.
Oh my, what, have you looked at the same ones that are there?
No, I could just remember them. What's the difference
between a Lada and a golf ball? Final one.
I don't know either.
You can drive a golf ball 200 metres. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce, thank you very much.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.